I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to the Des Bishop Podcast, live from the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. When I say live, I mean in the bedroom of my Airbnb in Melbourne during the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. We have a great guest today, David O'Doherty. Many of you know him. For those that don't, he is one of the most accomplished comedians we've had on this podcast. I've also known him longer than everyone other than two people on that have been on this podcast. Great comic, star of the Melbourne Festival, star of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, just taking part in various shows all over the world, plus the 2008 Edinburgh Comedy Award winner. The list goes on and on. Super interesting guy. Has written so many different things, including a current series of children's books called Dangers Everywhere, a children's book before he even started doing comedy called Ronan Long Gets It Wrong, and also facts about animals series. So much work to discuss, and I chose to try to focus as much as possible on that work for my chat with Dave. Hope you guys enjoy it. There's a little cameo with James Acaster, another great British comic, at the end. So do stick around for that, although it wasn't planned. But so don't think, oh God, we're having a long chat with James Acaster. It's just literally a cameo. Anyway, enjoy the chat, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Good evening. Dahi is Anam Dham. Agus Tom. Tom. Maconi in Melbourne, in Australia, probably something like that.
Austral.
Anish. August is La Jazz is a.
It's far green, me. That's a, I'm a comedian.
I know what it is.
Or Fuerstor. There's a Fuerstor.
Yeah, but there's
one.
The gray area. I don't want to say I'm a clown. You know, like I used
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I know. That was the problem. It's like, are you saying you're a clown?
I used to live in that, in a bedsit house in Raglan Road. I won't say the number. With
you did.
Technically, there was a children's clown. There was like a guy called Johnny who was actually did birthday parties. There was Brian, who was like a trained French Lecoq clown.
Oh, BQ.
Yeah. There was my brother, who's an acting
clown. Oh, that
clown.
Famous house, yeah.
And there was me. So it was the house of the four clowns, which, yeah.
That's in Tisha Ginaduct. To say that properly, that's tough grammar.
I've stopped.
The house of the clowns. Well, that's fun. It's funny that you should mention that, because I definitely had nostalgia on my mind today chatting to you.
Well,
because other than Deirdre O'Kane, of the people I've interviewed,
yeah,
you're the person I've known the longest. Oh, other than my brother, obviously.
I probably met you in 1998.
Yeah, well, essentially one of your first gigs.
One of my first gigs. Yeah, I did. My first gig was in the Norseman Bar.
Thursday night.
Which is now. Was it Thursday night? Which is now. I wonder what that's called now.
I don't know if it's called the Norseman, but that room is still up there. I always look up and at that room.
It was silly. It had shields and stuff on the walls.
Yeah, but it was a good room.
Yeah, it was a good room. Well, except that it was more the gigs were so good in that era because. My first show was Jason Byrne hosting and Tommy Tiernan closing. And
yeah.
And I think my brother did a little bit on it. And like, if I'd been working in London, it would have been 4 years before I got to meet anyone who was
like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Tommy Tiernan was about to win the Perrier Award with the Jesus Show.
98.
But you yeah. were. So that was.
But you. So you didn't gig at all the summer of 97, no?
No. I started first gig. Started the summer in 98 then.
Oh, so it was, yeah, because I met you at the International, obviously.
Yeah, that was my second gig, which was with Ard Lohanlon then as well. When he was Father Ted.
Massive.
The third series of Father Ted had just come out.
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, it was crazy time to be starting out. Also, I remember that year, 98, I just started. But then everyone went to the Edinburgh Fringe in August. So I was just did loads of gigs for the likes of...
That summer.
Yeah, that summer, which was a real drop you in it. Ones where you can't be shit. Like, you know, the thing about doing the Norseman and the International at the start was like, you would be given the little spot. And it didn't, you know, if it went badly, it wasn't the end of the world. But suddenly you're...
Yeah, you were the 20-minute guy getting paid because there was nobody around.
Yeah, you're getting 75 quid to go in Milano pizza.
Oh, yeah.
I died so badly there.
Everyone died in Milano, man.
it's a
incredibly attractive woman that organized that gig.
My main memory was old people. They used to get loads of old people. I think they got buses of people from from Nassau Street.
That was a mistake. But let's not focus on the terrible gigs of that era.
And my early set was like jokes about PlayStation games and stuff like that. And these people have lived through wars. You know what I mean? And I'm talking to them about...
Yeah, but it was also just spread out and people were there for a pizza. I mean, there was like... And like some people were like, hey, there's comedy on tonight. Would you like to sit in the comedy section of the place?
I mean, I do wonder if 19 years on, I would be able to do that now. You know, it was those gigs were so... Like the unfair thing about comedy is that you get better and crowds... generally come to see you.
Yeah, the crowds get better, so
they
too.
They get easier. Yeah. So the hardest part ever is when,
a good point.
Is when you're no good.
And you're playing the shittiest scenario.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Like, yeah. It's totally not fair.
It's totally not fair, especially then when you go and see, like, big comedians in theaters. You start to go and see them. And like they get a
well, you get that 15-minute honeymoon period, like just
ovation
that,
when you
that
come
early
out.
That first 10 minutes of those gigs is just like you could say whatever you want.
Yeah, for sure. But then compare that with your first couple of solo shows where no one knows who you are, and you're on stage for too long, and you come out and everyone's got their arms folded, you know, as in this is probably going to be shit. Like they're the hardest gigs in a way.
So let's talk about what I consider one of my happy memories of comedy is those first couple of years of the International Comedy Club. Not the Comedy Cellar, but the Thursday nights when I took over.
Yes.
And it was just at the time that you started,
yes.
Which I always tell people was very lucky because myself and yourself and eventually guys like Carl Spain.
Yeah.
We, the same people used to come to the show every week.
That era, yeah.
And we were stuck.
That's probably
having to sort of improvise
completely because if you changed one line afterwards, someone would come up to you and go, I like that new line you've put in that joke. I've heard eight times.
There was Francis
before.
And those girls, and I used to get them to do this, but there was just a little Francis and Frank, and then these two girls. Anyway, there was just a little crew of people before it started to grow.
Yeah,
I was always grateful because that was like luckily creative time and place to have. Particularly the sort of end of the show, 15, 20 minutes. You remember that? The show used to finish. I was hosting. And
if I hadn't been on, I remember walking in just my undies a few times.
Yeah, you used to just come on stage. But there was on a serious note, there was like an energy or an atmosphere, a playful atmosphere that was kind of conducive to thinking, oh shit, anything is possible.
Yes, that's true. And then very often, which is a valuable lesson to earn, very often, if something is spontaneous and truly spontaneous, it's actually much funnier than the jokes you've spent ages trying to write as well. And then you're kind of like, hey, I should not give a shit this much all of the time.
Now, like you used to often come up the stairs like in the middle of my hosting and just be like, oh, sorry, is this comedy? You know, you just like do
I remember coming up on my bike a few times and things like that. But yeah.
No, but we used to fuck around with the keyboard. And
that was a very beautiful era of, that was the first sort of messing around that I did. You know, because like, I didn't really know what I was at the start. My early sets would have just been lists of jokes, like non sequitur, you know, one-liners. And
yeah, but funnily enough, I always thought you knew a bit more about what you wanted to be when you started, much more than I did. Like I sort of fell into comedy and I loved it, but I always felt like you were a bit more comedy literate when you started.
I mean, I was certainly obsessed with comedy at the start because my brother had been doing stand-up for 4 years before me, and I'd gone to every, like those people who went to see
our
show every week. I'd been that person for the previous 5 years of going to every show around town and kind of waving at Barry Murphy.
Yeah, because I started doing comedy within sort of 5 months of seeing my first live comedy show.
Yeah, no, I'd been since 90, my brother started 93, and I used to go to pretty much all of his gigs then, and I really liked, my dad was a big comedy fan, is a big comedy fan, and he always had tapes, weirdly, of Steve Wright, you know, like one-liner people, and then weird American guys from the 60s, like Professor Irwin Corey, and, you know, that sort of hipster comedy movement of that came out of jazz clubs.
Yeah.
Because dad's a jazz musician. And so we were always listening to that.
Yeah, so you were very exposed.
Yeah, and then my brother took me to see Kevin McAleer when I was in about fourth year in school then, and it fucking blew my mind. You know, because it was him and the Olympia did two halves. It was him with the slideshow, like the real classic first period of Kevin McAleer. And it was just the fact that one person being on stage for that long, I think, with no set.
It just blew you away.
Yeah, it really did. And I didn't think about, like, oh, I'd love to do that one day. It was
Do you think that if your brother hadn't done comedy, that you would have done comedy?
My brother only did comedy. My brother was an actor, is an actor. And there was a period where there was no work in Dublin in the 90s. Mark was doing a lot of cleaning for like children's nurseries and stuff like that, you know, just to make to supplement his dole. And he was certainly drawn to that scene. I don't know, I was drawn to it as well, in that, like, I remember reading an interview with Dylan Moran once, and he was on stumbling upon the Dublin comedy scene of, there would have been a few years before, but he just went into it going, this is going to be shit. And he was just so pleasantly surprised, because it was Barry Murphy, Kevin Gildee, Ardal O'Hanlon, Pom Boyd, all those people. I love the Dylan line is, I thought it was going to be awful, but it was like Berlin Cabaret in the 1930s, someone would get up and kill a swan, someone would play a chocolate piano. And that was kind of the scene that I was looking at then. You know, and that, they were all so broke. I really liked it. You know, there'd be a fist fight over briquettes after every show among those sort of older guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, but then, one of the big differences, and like, I sound like I'm a million years old now, is that there was no money when we were getting, like, there was no career plan whatsoever. Mm. There was doing those gigs where, like, you'd get whatever, you'd get 20 quid for doing the gig, and, or 75 quid for doing the dying in the pizza place or whatever. And, but there was no, I remember talking to Kitson about this, like, there was Eddie Izzard and Kevin McAleer did theatres. That was pretty much it.
In your mind, right?
Well, that's all there was, and there were no comedy clubs in Ireland.
No,
at all.
Yeah.
So the aspiration wasn't to move on to the next level. It was just, this is really fun, let's try and write more things for next week. I certainly had no
career
trajectory. You know, I ended up going to Edinburgh, and which was just a kind of a continuation of that scene. But it was just nice because it was just for its own sake, really. And then meeting kind of people who are starting out super fresh like yourself, and then like Ruben the Mime, and
yeah, even though that was actually a little late, it's funny how time becomes Maeve came late. A good bit later,
yeah,
actually.
yeah but like that was just my scene for till about 2006, I would say, you know, 6 years I was in there most weeks.
Yeah, so a couple of things I want to ask you. I remember in the early days You used to talk a lot about jazz and the sort of jazz inspiration. Was that just wank, or did you actually feel like you were inspired by jazz music in your comedy?
Well, my dad's...
No, I knew that.
Yeah, but that's what dad did. And I always really liked the non-preciousness of jazz, whereby there'd be no one at dad's gigs. You know, dad would have a gig in J.J. Smith's. Dad would have a gig downstairs in what Reynard's or whatever pub was doing jazz at that time. And there would be four people there.
Yeah.
And dad afterwards would be like, oh my God, that was such a fun gig. You know, because yeah. it was him and the trio. They just had their own vibe. And I always really respected that. I liked the fact that they would turn things inside out quite a lot. You know, where you...
And you were never embarrassed for him. You were never going like, this is shit.
No, because that was... That's... He was doing exactly what he wanted to do from a very early age. I wanted to be a jazz musician. Like, I ran jazz gigs when I was 20, 21. Even when I started stand-up, I was sort of half involved in...
Yeah, because I remember you used to be involved like the Brad Meldow trio gigs and stuff.
So I got to know Brad Meldow, who's like now probably the most famous pianist in jazz, which is like saying the most famous double glazer in... Windows, but then he was spending a lot of time in Dublin, and he was just at a level so far ahead of anything I would ever be.
So did it ever find its way into your work, or was that just a thing that in your mind that I don't know, like a nice thing to feel?
I certainly it's still I listen to jazz. I listen to it around gigs. I just like the idea that there isn't a set script that you can go off in numerous directions. But as regards going on with nothing and sort of improvising your way out of it, you know, I do that sometimes, but I wish I did more of that. But
there's still, to me,
purity to the idea of jazz music, which is it's not like a smoke machine when you walk out on stage. It's not like really loud pre-show music and someone shouting, get ready for this gig. It's just this thing that exists on its own. And I've always been inspired by that.
Yeah.
Just from you need these sort of touchstones of purity, I think, in your life. And it's still what I aspire to. And I still, like, I'd like to think that my shows are getting better and heading towards this idea. They'll probably never get there.
But do you think part of the sort of being around that all your life and seeing your dad being this expert musician, because I always felt that you were really concerned about getting better at the form all the time, like the form of stand-up comedy, so to speak, you know, always trying to learn more, get better.
Yeah.
Do you think that part of that came from that?
I mean, yeah.
Everybody has that, but I just feel like you were...
Sure. I never really thought about... thought about it like I'm trying to learn, but I just remember going to as many gigs, still do go to loads and loads of gigs, but particularly in that period, just going to every gig ever. Like my first couple of Edinburghs was just wanting to see all these different styles of comedy, and then definitely doing my own shitty version of some of them, you know, probably on stage in the International, you know, where, because I started gigging with Flight of the Conchords in 2002. And just remember, like, writing some songs that were just like Flight of the Conchords songs then.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I felt like that was a kind of a moment in your life, that 2002 Edinburgh, where suddenly you really find some kindred spirits.
Yeah, there was I did the newcomer competition in 1999, and the final of that was me, Jimmy Carr, Andy Zaltzman, who was like John Oliver's double act partner, Josie Long, Juliet Cowan, and a few others. And so of that lot, me and Andy would still be very close. Me and Josie would still be very close. And
you didn't mention that you won.
He won.
He won it. That's why you think you're funny, 1999.
Yes, I won. That's where I won the massive cardboard check. For a, like, they gave me one of those huge cardboard checks for £1,000, and I thought it was real. I always thought huge checks.
One day you'd be walking into the bank with the huge check.
I thought the deal with checks was they were a legal tender. It didn't matter what size they were on if it just had the sort code at the bottom, and this had a sort code. So I brought it home to Dublin in my case.
Not.
Yeah, I did, and I took it to the permanent TSB on a Baker Street Bridge, the massive check.
You did not.
Yeah. And, like, they still talk about it. That's still my bank. And they still, they were like, that. This
I
is
wish,
not.
You know, back in the day, though, that would have been a viral. You know, sorry, if that had been now, I should say, that would have been a viral. David O'Doherty tries to cast massive checks.
And so, yeah, I met Daniel Kitson, would have been. Like, there would be a few seminal figures that I, like yourself, and then the stuff. Yeah, but that I was we a little earlier doing.
Than that. We were starting out together.
I'm talking about chronologically.
Yeah.
And then.
I always felt like that Edinburgh time for you was just like huge. From the show about a breakup, which was like a tough undertaking.
Yeah.
To meeting the lads. Like that was just, to me, was you kind of going like, who am I as a comedian? And then explosion.
Well, I mean, it's a very slow explosion in that it takes another 6 years.
Yeah, well, I was thinking, what was that show? 2000, the one about breaking up?
2002.
That was 2002.
Yeah.
And then
not so much an explosion as, do you know in caves when water drips off the ceiling and over like 100,000 years, one of those stalactites fills up? That's more like my career.
Yeah, I didn't actually mean explosion career wise. I actually meant sort of like yourself as a performer.
There was in Edinburgh I was doing my own solo show, and then there was another it was called Best of Irish, where we'd all go and do a bit some nights
in the stand
in Cave One, and after that gig, where it was like some other gig, and I was just I'll watch a bit of this, see what it's like, and it was Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah.
And it was actually, there were two shows. There's one called Humor Beasts.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, you were there.
So I was there 2002.
So that's Jemaine Clement and Taika Waititi, who's just did Hunt for the Wilder People and has just directed the new Thor movie. So they were a double act. And then Concords were Brett and Jemaine. Pretty much, now they did have their shit together in that they were
Particularly the Flight of the Conchords.
Yes.
Humor Beast was fun, but it was a little more chaotic than Flight of the Conchords.
And so that was to no one in a dripping cave. And then last summer I toured with Concords around America, and we did like Red Rocks to 12,000 or whatever. You know, so that's that particular journey.
Yeah, but that was an amazing time. Like that little
they were just so good. Well, the rest of us were sort of floundering, you know, the John Oliver and Josie, and we were all trying to figure out the sort of thing we wanted to do.
Yeah, but you weren't even friendly with John Oliver by that stage, were you?
I would have met them that year.
Yeah, because we all used to play football every day in the Meadows, and
so the Bush
touch rugby.
Yeah, the Bush had just come and gone. And they were sort of heading
towards better things. The Naked Samoans used to play tip rugby with us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And they're now, most of those are in Taika's movies now.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I remember we all used to go and watch them pretty much every night, Flight of the Conchords.
Yeah. It was a very interesting time as regards, I don't know, I just remember floundering a lot. I remember being like, my show's no good, but I see the thing. I don't see the thing that I want to do, but I see the next step along the way where it could be better than this. And that was definitely, 2002 was a huge year for me.
Yeah, I felt like that was like a kind of a turning point. You found major inspiration.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Being around those guys.
Absolutely broke on my arse though, you know, until for like no one came. No, some people came in 2002. Some people came in 2003. You know, I'd do a show in Edinburgh, and then I'd do a little run of it in the Project Arts Centre in Dublin.
Yeah.
But it was like mounting credit card bills sort of vibe. I met Dimitri Martin in 2003, and he was another one of those people who had his shit together. You know, as in, he had a unique view. In his case, it was one-liners mixed with this kind of weird existential doubt and gaps in his life that he was trying to fill with, you know, around that period. He was writing out, it sounds like Scientology or something, but he was trying to improve his life using mathematics, where he'd rate every day. He would rate how healthy the food he'd eaten today was. You know what I mean? He was just, and that was sort of reflected in his weird shows then as well. And I remember seeing that also and being like, wow, that's really interesting. The idea of doing shitty jokes, which is still what I love doing, but then also being vaguely profound about it as well, about the place of shitty jokes in the world, which is out there is chaos. These are funny though.
But when did you start to sort of really rate yourself or just go, fuck it, like, it's got to start to be like me at the front of it all.
Because
I feel like abroad started to appreciate the skills and the master of David O'Doherty before back home.
I was always running my own gigs. I was always doing all the gigs that were on offer in Ireland, you know, which was a real mixed bag. You know, I remember once playing the foyer of Un Greenawn Theatre in Donegal with you.
Oh, yeah, we all did that.
You know what I mean? And just doing university gigs. I remember those gigs for Carol's Cigarettes.
It's been discussed on this podcast before.
Which is like something from the cigarettes. 1950s. Yeah.
I just discussed it. I just did an interview on Melbourne Uni Radio. And the guy was asking me about the old days. And I was like, yeah, we used to have gigs sponsored by Carol's Cigarettes and they gave out free cigarettes to students.
The one thing that I always think of with Carol's Cigarettes was, are Carol's Cigarettes still around?
I don't know.
They, Paddy Courtney is a Dublin comedian, and he used to nick loads of the cigarettes to give to his granny. And he'd always ring up his grandparents and he'd be like, the phone would answer, like, hello. And he'd be like, sorry, granddad, can you put granny on? This is your granny. And that is the ad for Carol's Cigarettes. That I always, someone getting three cartons of Carol's every week. Yeah, so there was all those kind of very odd gigs. So I was always hustling, you know, in that, like, putting on gigs.
Yeah, no, I know, yeah.
And it wasn't early on, I sort of twigged that I worked better. Like, there was a commercial comedy club opened in Dublin in about 2000, I would say.
Yeah, Left a Lounge.
Yeah, but I was never a great fit for that. So I was always doing my own thing. I always liked the hour, idea of the hour as well, because you can just stretch out. And also, playing songs as well isn't necessarily ideally suited to that clubby environment, you know, where you got to really follow it. You know,
although, it was in the Left Lounge. I don't know if you know this, but one night I was in the Left Lounge. I can't remember what the scenario was, but I had a quick line, which was, one day this economic boom will be over, the recession will be, or like the bad times will be back, and we'll be back to worrying about turning off the immersion again. and then I guess that night I went on a little bit of I started tagging on it, but just like off the top of my head. You pulled me to the side when I came off and you said, you got to explore that more. There's more in that. You actually said to me, there's more in that immersion thing. Push that a bit further.
Yeah, well.
Do you know that?
It's the sort of thing that I, you know, in that we were very
encouraging. Yeah, everybody was encouraging, yeah. But you definitely said there's more. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't have found it anyway, I remember you saying there's more in that. You got to explore that further.
That's interesting, yeah. And then I think it was, because I had a heartbreak thing in about 2002, that was, you know, everyone had a heartbreak thing in 2002. But I then tried to write a show about it. So it was, that was an interesting time, because up until then I'd just been writing silly jokes and one-liners and all about the world and looking out and all of that. And then suddenly I tried to write a show or try to be funny about the awful feelings that I had. I tried to explore feelings-based comedy. So that was a bit of a
but
breakthrough.
But that show wasn't bad.
That wasn't bad.
It was just, the room was fucking horribly hot. I remember that, fucking sweating my way through that show.
In Edinburgh, yeah, that was a tricky one. But no, what I'm saying is, artistically, if that's not too wanky a word, that was quite a significant show then as well. And then, it was an odd time because Dublin was booming at the time, but I was broke for all of that as well. Yeah. So I think that's where there was a kind of an awakening of, this is really weird that, like, it was that thing where obviously house prices were shooting up, and it's kind of like how it seems for millennial kids now. It was just like, oh, I'm going to live in this bedsit till I die.
Yeah, I'm not going to be a part of this.
Yeah, and I was about $4,000 in credit card debt at the time. So I think, and then the economy collapsed. Just when I was...
Started making money.
Well, it was sort of looking like I would start to pay off those bills.
Yeah.
It was just like the deepest recession in the history of a Western economy began.
Yeah.
But that was also then when I won the Perrier. So that was...
What, did you win in 08?
Yeah, 08. That was,
you won in 08.
Yeah, that was pretty much, I think, the week the really bad Irish stats came in.
Yes.
And the thing started to bottom out and... All the dickheads in the newspapers are like, it's just temporary. It's only, it's just going to last
people
a minute.
People talking down the economy should just kill themselves.
The really, truly ballsy people are buying property now because this is a temporary blip.
Was that like your thing, 08, 09, 2010, where you suddenly went, oh, this is, it was all fucking bullshit. It's
yeah.
Easy time to be cynical.
Yeah, it was an easy time to be. I mean, I always.
Well, you should have. Yeah, we should.
I was
been.
Always cynical.
Yeah.
And.
But I think you kind of started to really like let it out.
Yeah. Like. I remember...
like the end of Whimsy.
Well, like, Whimsy annoys me because... So, like, it's this thing where I've always tried to write
Well,
shows.
I never heard the term Whimsy until you used to put it in your show, like, something, something Whimsy. You used
yeah,
to actually
I know,
have the line.
I know I used to because I used to write shows about really serious things. Like, I used to try and write shows about feeling like a breakup or feeling depressed.
She
or,
left me in a hardware shop.
Yeah, that was the song. And the early on, it would just be like, oh, another whimsical, another silly. This show's so lightweight, it would blow away. And I was like, I was trying to open my fucking heart to you. And
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And I remember doing an interview in about 2004 with, I can't remember who was with, some journalist in Ireland who was like, I was like, and it's a very weird time we're living through in this country because with the tiger economy and he was like, but what did it used to be like? What are the changes? And I was like, I don't really know because...
This is
I've come
of age in this.
Yeah, I'd left school in 94 and it had kind of all graphs had been pointing upwards from that point onwards. And so I didn't really have any counterpoint to compare it to. But then when the thing went on its arse, I think that definitely
assisted.
Yeah,
now you do. And we had a right to be angry in the
And a right to be cynical and a right to be suspicious of pretty much everything we were told. So yeah, that was probably a turning point as well. I don't know. I never really think about this thing.
No, I know. I was just curious.
But yeah, your probing is probably correct there, Desmond.
Good. All right. Well, let me just ask you one other thing probing. Before we finish and go play football.
Oh shit. It's fine.
What time is it?
It's we're in no hurry.
Okay.
We've rented a pitch at 3.
And it's what time is it?
5 to 2.
Oh, okay, perfect.
You can go for 8.
We're going
to go for another 15 minutes.
Well, so in all this sort of your life, you know, like you're quite sort of like busy now all over the world. You've got, you're doing big shows. Then you have this other life, the children's writer life.
Yeah.
Which kind of was there from at the very beginning and then stopped.
When I would have met you first.
I had a book out.
I had a book out. Yeah,
what was it called again?
22.
Ronan Long gets it
wrong. About a boy who is a terrible inventor. Yeah, I was, because my parents didn't tell me it was a stupid idea. From about the age of 11 onwards, I was writing stories and then just sending them to the addresses inside children's books that I liked. You know what I mean? Like just put my story in an envelope and send it off to Penguin Publishing or whatever. And I actually still have some of the letters. I have this really funny one, which was, it's a hand-typed out letter from the editor of the Irish Times from about 1988, which was like, "Dear David, we are not interested in your series of ads. We strongly suggest you take a Guardian or a pair." Like, I had gone like, "Guys, hey Irish Times, I'm 11, I'm going to cycle right around the whole edge of Ireland and send you a dispatch every few days. Are you in?" And it's like a really nice letter just about, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Also, maybe you would have collapsed by the time you got to Arklow on your attempt to go clockwise around the country. And similarly, yeah, I was sending stories off. I used to get really nice letters back from
This desire was in you.
People who worked in children's. Well, they were like, no good. The stories were no good. But they were just like, keep going. This is great. You know, like real nice stuff like that. And I did keep going. And I was definitely inspired by, I was in university with Paul Murray, who's wrote Skippy Dies. You know,
a
book that was on the Booker list a couple of years ago. And he would like have his, in university, he would have his lecture notes, and then he would always be writing stories or books, just like real throwaway stuff.
You knew him, did you?
Yeah, I sat beside him.
Oh yeah, you were aware that he was doing this.
And it was just a thing that I'd never really thought about, of like, what if you just all the time are writing, and you know, bits, like a few lines of this thing, a short story that's four lines long or whatever. And so throughout university, I didn't do any work really. I wasn't that into economics or philosophy. But I met some very interesting people, and sort of through that then started writing stories for kids.
But what made you go kids? Like, what made you think I want
to
write kids?
Because I think I still to this day don't, I know what it takes to write a literary book, a novel. It takes years. Like, doing stand-up kind of ruins your mind in that you get the immediate reaction to, you know, I could think of a thing now and try it out tonight at the show.
No, but at the time, though, it was even pre-stand-up, no?
Yeah.
So what made you go kids?
Because I knew that Paul had been writing this novel from the age of about 16 onwards, like 4 years' work. And I just didn't have that within me. But I knew you could write shorter things. And I really enjoyed reading for, I'd worked with kids in care when I was in university.
Right, okay.
That was my job on the side, working as a sort of relief social worker at children's homes in Dunleary in Dublin. And I just enjoyed it. And I enjoyed just making rubbish up, you know, with kids.
Yeah.
Like my brother was just like, so many really developed lies in our childhood. You know, just really brain-provoking. Like, I remember, because my brother and sister, I think this is a really key thing for me, was they were 7, 8 years older than me. So they were massively my intellectual superior. And they were also my physical superior. So both of them could just get me down, put their knee on the back of my head, and make me say, you are the king.
You're the king.
And I remember my brother... We used to look at the Argos catalogue a lot when there was no Argos in Dublin, and just looking at the toys. And my brother had this thing going for about 2 years, which was, I have that. I have all of these toys. And he had them in a secret store somewhere in our house.
And you believed it?
Yeah, I believe. No, I'd be like, I don't believe you. But then I did believe it.
Yeah.
And then he would take me there. And like, just remember, this went on for like, this is the sort of fantasy world that I grew up in. This went on for 2 years. He'd be like, okay, it's fine. You're old enough now. I'll show you where it is. And he'd take me to, you know, like there was a shed, and he'd be like tapping on the wall of the shed. And then he would have this elaborate sort of heart attack seizure where he'd drop to his knees and fall on the ground dead, and then come around, like he'd stay down for ages. He'd come around and I'd be like, oh, thank goodness you're alive. You were about to show me where the secret store is. And he's like, I wasn't going to show you where it was. And I'd be like, no!
A 2-year buildup.
Yeah. So this, well, no, it would happen again and again. Yeah, yeah. And like a dog returning to its own shit. I would just
it's
keep
being
like. It's
kind of almost like having an uncle when you have a brother that's much,
yeah,
that's
exactly.
That much older
that
than
much
you.
Smarter. And yeah, there's a Kurt Vonnegut line about so often comedians are the youngest because they've never anything intelligent to say. In family conversations, like so my brother and sister will be talking about, you know, things they'd learned or great art projects they were working on, and I would just be like, guys, so I'd yeah
fart
dance, put peanut butter in hair, just be like peanut butter in my hair. So I think that so the children stuff definitely came from that, and then. Over the years, I did a few kids' shows. I did a kids' show. Me and Maeve Higgins did a kids'
show.
Yeah,
I was going to ask you about that. That, you know, like from that book, then it was always kept showing up.
We did a show where we were.
What's that called again? I Can't Sleep.
I Can't Sleep. Yeah, there's two beds on stage, and she was asleep, and I couldn't sleep. So I would ask the audience how to get to sleep.
Because I remember watching that and thinking, this is genius. Because kids love the simple game of, I'm trying to sleep.
Well, no one can get to sleep also. So it was a very relatable piece of, but we'd string it out to 45 minutes.
Yeah, but it was great because I thought, wow, it's amazing that Dave has figured out these little triggers.
Yeah,
entertain kids.
I think I do have something. To be honest, I don't think your sense of humor changes very much from the age of about 8 or 9. Honestly, like all the stuff I liked then, Fawlty Towers, Monty Python, you know, fair enough, you get a bit more sophisticated.
You get more sophisticated.
I wouldn't have been able to sit through Manhattan or something like, you know, the when I was 8. But as regards the silly jokes, Blackadder, you know, stuff like that, that's still the stuff that I really love.
What do you regret liking? Like I regret liking Andrew Dice Clay, even though he's had a sort of a career revival. But I did think those nursery rhymes were funny, and I'm surprised I didn't know.
I mean, I am in going back to stuff. I'm always intrigued by how certain things are just perfectly of their time. Like something like The Young Ones, because I remember my brother and sister used to watch that.
Yeah, they used to love that, right?
Which was, and I was like 6 or 7, but it was like the sort of punk new wave TV show. And if you watch it now, it's good as a sort of historic piece, but at the time, I totally see
that.
It's hard to be too critical when you're 13 or 14.
I'm like giving myself a hard time. It's just funny how it's just funny how you change. So I thought I Can't Sleep was great.
I'm doing a kids show tomorrow morning now at 11.
Yeah, I feel like Danger Is Everywhere is a bit more of it's a bit more substantial in terms of your kids' work in that you now have like a series of books.
Written 3 books of it. Yeah. Which is like, but a big influence on that was, you know, going back to 05, 06, meeting Claudia O'Doherty then, who's now, you know, in Love, the Judd Apatow series. And she and I then wrote 2 books with Mike Ahern. We did 2 books of fake facts about animals. In like 09, 10 then. And I definitely Danger Is Everywhere came from that because these were books that looked like they were reference books for grown-ups and they were just horse shit facts about
sharks.
Yeah. And that sort of unlocked something within me then to try and do a similar thing for kids. But you had to do it. The workaround was you couldn't write fake reference books for kids because kids didn't know what references were. So instead, it's just a very unreliable man who's worried about, say, sharks coming up out of the loo or whatever it happens to be. And that's the basis of Danger Is Everywhere then, which, now so I do a lot of shows of that during the day at festivals like this.
Whose idea was it that the illustrations were just as important? Like that came from Claudia or that came from Mike? Or the original sort of evolution?
The original of the Sharks and the Pandas books. I was very into I think they were called the Usborne book of, it'd be like the paranormal or ghosts. One of those books you read when you're about 8 as you're eating your breakfast cereal. You're just staring at these sort of drawings of UFOs. And it was a highly... there were a lot of pictures. It was about 60% pictures. So we wanted to go back to that era of slightly unreliable. And, you know, because I was like all kids, I was obsessed with like Loch Ness Monster and
shark
attacks. I spent so much of my life worried about, especially going on holidays to Achill every year where my granny had lived, just like shark attacks and what to do if there was a shark attack, you know, peeing on jellyfish stings and all of that. And that was from those books. So we wanted to try and replicate those books, which, and the book never, of that first series, which was for grown-ups, it never admitted that it wasn't real. So consequently, it's the funniest Amazon reviews ever, because it's like half of them are really good and the other half are just like, I thought this was a book of facts about pandas. What the hell is it? So it just, in order to seem real, we needed amazing Photoshop. And because I'd met the daddy guys who are...
Because I remember that you were connected with them from way back in the
day. Yeah, I used to do gigs at Warlords of Pez and used to do gigs with the Chalets then. I was always doing... around the time I was doing gigs with you in the international, I would also do gigs with like David Kitt and
All that. You were always just connected with interesting people.
David O'Doherty
is a story of connections with interesting people, in fairness.
Well, I think playing a little keyboard meant it was easier to do music gigs as well.
Yeah.
Also, when you came out, people would often think, especially if I opened with a song that had a big musical intro, people would think I was a super earnest musician who was just happened to be playing a novelty keyboard. Then.
The equivalent of a ukulele, really.
Oh, man, don't say that.
No, just in terms of the guy comes out with the Yamaha.
Yeah, like it's not... I know it is fundamentally ridiculous. And I know people must see, oh, the guy who thinks he's fucking hilarious playing the little keyboard. But like, there was a real practicality to it. There always has been, which is I've carried around big pianos and hired big pianos for gigs. It's a pain in the arse. Whereas this, it's very convenient, especially for jumping on stage with bands and stuff like that. We can just plug into a guitar socket and away you go. So while, like, I think it is sort of funny with the shitty beats and all that, the sort of convenience of it is the main reason I think I still play them.
Getting laughs off the shitty beats? 19 years later, we still get laughs off the shitty
beats. My entire career is people laughing at my shitty beats.
Yeah, but anyway, I just want to stay on this just for another sec. So it's funny how, well, first of all, you have an incredible ability to sort of stay connected to like the shit you used to like when you were a kid.
Really?
Well, just in the sense that like you're able to still know, like you were saying a minute ago, I remember liking these things. Like that stays fresh. Yeah. Like I don't have as much of a connection to like what I found interesting when I was a kid.
Oh, right.
Like in terms of turning it.
Yeah.
Like creating something that other kids would then find interesting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I know it's not that I watch Blackadder every day, you know, and I realized the sort of sitcom form is being turned its head by a, you know, bunch of American shows. You know, even in the last few years, shows like Fleabag have come along where it's just, oh shit, this is something new.
No, but I meant in relation to the...
I definitely still have the ability to get obsessed with things. You know, that's... maybe this will change in future years when I have a child or something like that. But I still... You know, the modern concept of binge-watching a thing, that's always been my entire life. Just...
Getting obsessed with a thing.
Getting obsessed with a thing. Staying up for, like, 20 hours working on a song. Or, you know, me and Connor Creaney would work on a musical thing for... And just, it would be tomorrow. And we would still be doing it.
But now you have kids. Now you meet kids. And the dads are like, oh, my kid loves Dangerous Everywhere.
I mean, that is one of the most joyous parts of this job at the moment is kids come to the kids' shows dressed as the guy from Dangerous Everywhere.
Yeah.
Especially when kids come in Australia. Like, just... Which is so far from the... Whatever, bathroom in Dublin where I probably thought about it, the book for the first time.
Pre-flush.
And they're... That's or the other thing that really knocks me out is when people are... Like, I've seen six of your shows. You know, that is... You know, people have just come back. Because I've done a shitload of shows now. like a new hour every year.
No, I know, yeah. But I was just thinking in terms of the kid book, it's pretty amazing. Also, just in terms of how one of your earliest jokes was about performing to kids and how their heckles were ruthless.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I feel like it was kind of like it was in you anyway.
Yeah, it's
like there was just this awareness of entertaining kids.
Well, it's like basically the same. Like it is actually the same. You know, sometimes I wish I had at those kids' gigs, I get a roving mic and I walk around sort of like Springer style and shove it in people's faces and ask them, what's a dangerous thing?
Because kids say the darndest things.
Ask them about dangers at school and stuff. Yeah, and they do say the darndest things. And then they say like incredibly dark things.
Oh,
as
really?
Well. Yeah.
Have you got any great examples? I hate putting you on the spot, but I do love that shit.
We talk about vampires a bit, or ghosts, and people will have actual... Like, and what I want is silliness with ghosts. Like, I kind of... You know, the deeper philosophical idea of the Danger is Everywhere book is that everyone is scared of loads of things, and that's cool. You know, I was really, when I was little, I was really scared of the dark. And then,
yeah, me too. I wouldn't go upstairs without my dog.
Yeah, or in the west of Ireland, I got really obsessed with banshees and, you know, all of that sort of real dark.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the first time I heard about banshees. Yeah, that shit stayed
really terrifying, especially when you're walking around Echo Island after... 9 p.m. where it's that sort of pitch darkness where you can only feel the road under your feet. You know, that is a terror engine. And so with the Danger books, I want people to, I guess, similar to listening to economist Jim Power talk about how the Irish economy is going to be fine in the year 2008, I love the idea of a grown-up character who's just full of shit so that a six-year-old can look at him and be like, this guy isn't all that. He seems to think that there's a thing called a toothbrush snake, which lies beside your actual toothbrush and you put toothpaste on it. Just that you will learn that fear is.
So is that
everywhere.
The live show? Is you.
The live show is no, I don't. I talk about the. It's actually. Well, when I do it with Chris Judge, he just draws live. So we ask the audience what they're scared of. And then we just kind of make fun of it, and the audience realize that everyone else is scared of the same stuff of them as well. And by the end of it, Chris has drawn a picture of the girl who's scared of sharks being eaten by a shark, you know what I mean, etc., etc. So we all just sort of get it out in the open is the idea of the kids shows, and hopefully they're funny then as well. But that, yeah, I mean, I don't know, I like the freedom of the kids gigs because there really isn't a plan in them. Sometimes I wish my stand up I could be that sort of free with them, but maybe it's my jazz dreams.
You could do that after a year off in Edinburgh. You could come back and do a
mess around show. Well, yeah, I definitely like the reason.
By the way, it's a good time. I meant to say it seems to be a good time to be doing this kids show because there's a fucking huge demand for it.
Yeah, well, the books have been popular.
Yeah, but also just, I feel like nowadays parents love bringing their kids to like these types of shows.
Well, I do know that for my friends with kids, if...
They're fucking dying to go
They're
to
dying
shit.
To do anything.
Especially something
not
they could get.
Terrible. So if you can put on something reasonable for kids, the grown-ups will be like, all right, I'll get a coffee and
But the grown-ups get a kick out of
it.
Oh,
yeah, well, we relentlessly mock the grown-ups then. So they do get them. Like, I just... With all, like, you've asked me to this podcast a couple of times, and I
wasn't going to bring it up that you were resistant to doing my podcast.
No, I'm not resistant to doing your podcast. I'm resistant to. I just think I hopefully I'm going to do something good in the next few years.
Dave, you're full of shit.
And I want to. Not that I think this isn't good, the stuff that I'm doing now, but I still think there's something. This is all going somewhere. Yeah, and even talking about...
Yeah, but isn't it this, okay like, to... It's good where it is as well.
Yeah, it totally is. But
you're not dismissing the future by saying, fuck, it's actually been all right till now.
No. But I don't want to be like a smugatron who's like... And then, of course, I realized that the main point of comedy was to ameliorate suffering in the world or whatever.
No, but people,
I don't know
people
anything.
Find people interesting.
I'm pretty sure if I listen back to this in 20 years' time, I'll be like, that guy's an asshole talking about me, you know, that I sound like I know something. But I do, I work so I work so much and I work so hard and I like write ideas down on my hands and bits of paper all around this hotel room, and that's, it's going somewhere, you know? And it's also, maybe it won't ever get there, but I like the idea that it is all still going.
Yeah, but hilariously, the funny thing is that all the stuff you write, all the bits of creativity that you do, all the successes that you've had, the shows, the TV shows, the books, like it's all fucking interesting, entertaining stuff, as if a conversation with you wouldn't also be interesting. Like, why would you separate your work from yourself so much? Like, in terms of like you thinking, you doing other people's thinking, it's kind of ridiculous because of course it's going to be interesting.
I don't, well, the
people find it interesting to listen to people. Play,
the iTunes plays on this sitcom or in this podcast will be the telling factor as to whether this.
Well, to be honest, they're always the same for mine. So
are they really?
Yeah, you're just gonna, you know, there's gonna be a sort of a good amount of Irish people, and then some scattered listeners around the world that definitely like listening to the musings of comedians. And the chats go different ways, you know, like. Like with you, I did want to talk about the work because, you know, you've done so much work and it's really interesting. You know, with Ursula Carlson, we talk about her being, you know, like raising her daughter in same-sex marriage,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like super interesting. Everybody's different things,
yeah.
You know? Some people are really fucked up, so you talk about their fucked up.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But I was curious about the work with you because I always admired your commitment to the work, and I always admired or sometimes actually felt bad for you because you've, your fucking standards are so relentlessly difficult that even now at the end of this conversation, you're thinking, nah, it's just not good. I'm not good enough. I'm not good enough.
No, I'm not like that at all. I also, like, I'm so fucking lucky to do this. You know, which is another thing that I got from my dad, in that, like, this is my obsession, this job. Like, doing stand-up, doing the kid stuff. I think about it all the time. You know, like, I am really excited to do the probably 60th gig of this tour tonight. And it'll be super fun, you know? And I also don't... But, like, hearing that... I know a lot of people aren't as lucky and don't love their jobs. And work's just a thing they get through and then get to their own shit in the evenings and the weekends. And so I also don't want to rub it in people's faces.
No, but then on the flip side, I guess, on a Saturday and Sunday, they're just fucking chilling. Whereas on a Saturday and Sunday, we're like fucking thinking, Jesus, I got to write this fucking thing.
I know, but also all those people are in work right now. And I am dressed in...
and this fucking wanker's going on about his fucking kids shows.
I'm dressed in 70s football gear.
I know.
Ready
well,
to...
this is the other highlight of our jobs, is that we get to play football together, you know, and all that stuff. Hey, look, it's a great life. But I think, damn, you do. You know what? You fucking do a lot of other people's thinking more than I thought.
What do you mean?
Like you're always worried about how people are going to perceive shit, like in terms of this conversation.
I just don't want to do boring stuff. Yeah. I don't want to just do output that's, you know. We get asked to do a lot of things that aren't that.
I think someone's at your door.
Oh wow!
Hello?
No.
Oh, hang on.
Maybe it is. I'll fill the. Oh, it's just the water guy. Oh, sorry. I thought it was like another comedian. It would have been great if we could have had a cameo.
James Acaster.
Oh, it's James Acaster. We're in the middle of a podcast, but we're actually finishing, James. So you can come in. We're finishing.
Apologies, guys.
No, but James, it's no problem. Sit down. Sit down and join us at the end of our podcast, if you don't mind. I haven't had a chance to talk to your agent, but
so
James Acaster is here for some shorts because he's also going to play football. And we were just wrapping up, Dave. We've been talking for an hour and 8 minutes.
Oh God! I hope I wasn't just gazing up the leg of my trousers, James, and saying non-philosophical things, which is inappropriate.
We did say joking that we would discuss your wang, and here it is at the end of the conversation being discussed.
Well, it is,
James. The conversation has been of a higher quality than this.
I'll come in. So
basically, the last bit of this has been me going, I also realize how lucky I am doing this.
He did
job.
Wankily say that, by the way.
And
I'm
how
so
lucky,
lucky
I am while people are doing real jobs.
Yeah.
And then just as I was saying that, you call in to borrow football shorts so we can go and live our life of absolute leisure.
Our fucking never-ending college life. Like, yeah. Our never-ending dorm existence, yeah. That we fucking have, that we just go, come on, we're going to be late for football, man. Yeah. Anyway, look, we'll leave it there. I don't want to be rude to James.
I'm the one who's interrupted.
We did an hour. We did an hour and
I
eight.
No, but you're getting famous enough that it seems like a good cameo. Yeah.
So
like there's going to be some comedy fans out there like, wow, how cool is that? He was talking to David Attari, then James Acaster just came in for a pair of shorts. This is a perfect ending. Yeah.
Yeah. So edit this down. You edit this down to a good 15 minutes.
A good 50, man. No, there's 15, a good 50 in there.
15. Get it right down. Just the highlights.
Just the shorts.
And then, yeah, just James' cameo.
Yeah, the 3-minute podcast.
Be a real kick
Who's
in the
at
teeth
the
for me.
Yeah. Who's at the door? Oh my God, it's James Acaster. We're literally making a sitcom. We didn't even know that we were doing it. It's like James. And then James comes in. It's like, what's going on, James? Like, you're never going
to
believe it.
Or James is killed at football today. And this is his last ever media appearance. So this will play at
man,
the funeral.
This would be so highly rated.
Really sad.
Yeah. Oh, can I ask you guys a question?
Do the ratings, no problem.
Can I ask you a question? I don't have a fear of flying, but for some reason on some flights, I ponder the crash.
Yeah.
Do you ever console yourself by knowing that like it will do wonders for the sales of all your existing stuff?
I don't have enough stuff that's out there. So for me, I'm just like, oh.
Fuck, there's not enough
I
stuff
really
out there.
I wish I had more merch. Yeah, that's all I think on the flights. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think, from the Danger is Everywhere children's book series point of view, like it would be the perfect circle if... the man who wrote Dangers Everywhere died the ultimate dangerous death. But I don't think that's something people would really want to inflict on their kid. It would almost make it too, you know.
Yeah, it's be too like emotional.
If the Doors had been a children's band and then Jim Morrison choked to death in his own vomit, I don't think people would be like, oh, we'll still play that for our kids. It's almost too bleak.
And then who do you think, you know, the way that people continue to write great series of books after the author dies because people just love it.
Oh, yeah.
Who would be your writer to keep the Dangerous Everywhere series going?
Oh, wow. It'd be someone who doesn't quite get it and would do a really, really bad job of them.
Brendan O'Carroll.
And then I would come back and try and haunt them from beyond the grave. I don't think Brendan O'Carroll would be bothered doing the Dangerous Everywhere series. I think he's got bigger, enormous sharks to fry.
You'd let Chris Judge carry it on solo.
Yeah, Chris Judge and Chris O'Dowd then.
Oh yeah, Chris O'Dowd. People just think it was you.
Great, we really missed them.
All right, anyway, come on, that was great. Thank you for a little addition at the end, James. So thanks very much to Dave, and thank you for James for giving us a little bit of punctuation at the end of the chat. I'll have Tom Ballard next week, guys. Tom Ballard, a great Aussie comic who is super interesting, and he's doing a show here at the festival. A little bit about sort of middle class white privilege and the bubble, sort of liberal bubble that some of us can live in. So look forward to that chat. And what else can I say? Well, listen, guys, keep the old ratings going on iTunes. Send me a message on Snapchat, Des Buffer, facebook.com/Des Bishop, Twitter @Des Bishop, Instagram Des Bishop. And thanks for your feedback for the Dara and Ursula chats. We're also going to have a Bandoman on soon. I don't know when, but I have chatted with Rob from a Bandoman, and we will be having a chat. And I hope to have somebody, at least two or three more chats from Melbourne, and then hopefully some from Sydney, and maybe even a Perth chat. So keep coming back, guys. Keep spreading the word. And, oh yeah, there's one more week to go of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. So if you haven't seen my show, come see my show, 7:15. Tuesday to Saturday, and 6:15 on Sunday. No show on Monday, and then I'm in Sydney in 2 weeks' time, and I'm in Perth in 3 weeks' time. So anyway, guys, chat to you soon. Thanks so much. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.